You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by the MLB.com Shop.
Hi, this is Phil Rogers, MLB.com Extras, National League Central Edition. It's almost time for spring training, almost time to see Jung Ho Kang, almost time to see John Lester in a Cubs uniform. So much to look forward to. And the weather won't hurt at all either in Arizona and Florida. As always, joined by Jennifer Langosh. Jen, you just about ready to get headed down to Jupiter for spring training?
Yeah, it's hard to believe it's time for baseball again, especially when you step outside here in St. Louis and feel the frigid temperatures here. But very excited for the year ahead and covering kind of what's ahead and what's unknown for the Cardinals this year.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like I'm working on a column today, and the gist of it is going to be the two central divisions, the same powers we would have had a year ago. I think the Cardinals and the Detroit Tigers will probably be the consensus picks, as they have been for, it seems like, a few years now, but maybe the distance not quite the same. And our colleague Anthony Kastrovitz, I think, touched on a big difference is kind of the confidence in the Cardinals' starting rotation. Anthony ranked the top 10 rotations in baseball and had the Cardinals number 8, which, you know, that's pretty darn good. Nothing wrong with being in the top third. But a year ago, I think they, you know, given their depth and Adam Wainwright without the questions that he faces now, probably would have had them as one of the top couple of rotations. Do you see that as a significant difference, Jen?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think their depth right now is kind of what's in question. I mean, certainly this was a team that had to change its offseason plans because of a tragedy early in the winter, and as a result, sent Shelby Miller, one of their young promising pitchers, out to Atlanta so that they could get Jason Hayward. And, you know, that deal certainly seems to make the offense more formidable. It addressed a hole in the bullpen, but what it did do with the starting pitching side is it took out a pitcher who's, you know, been very reliable for this team the last 2 years, and really with what Shelby showed, especially at the end of 2014, a pitcher that the Cardinals had big promise for in the coming year. So, you know, when you take him out of the mix, and certainly the Cardinals are very excited in what they could have in a Carlos Martinez and a Marco Gonzalez, but the reality is that those two pitchers combined have just a little more than a dozen major league starts between them. And then when you look at the injury concerns with a Jaime Garcia, who's made 16 starts combined over the last 2 years, with a Michael Wacha, who missed half the season last year with a very rare shoulder condition that, you know, while the Cardinals think they have a handle on it, really, you know, if they're being honest, aren't sure what's kind of ahead for Michael in that regard. And then certainly with Adam Wainwright, who had elbow cleanup surgery this offseason. And again, Waino, you know, is committed to pitching a full season and carrying kind of the workload that he has in recent years. But the Cardinals also understand that they're probably going to have to back off a little bit so as to keep him sharp until the end of the season and, as they hope, into October. So, you know, when you have some questions with the injury side of things, with some aging pitchers, with the unknown of some of these young guys coming up and with a little less depth than they've enjoyed in the last couple of years, yeah, I mean, I think there are some questions for the rotation. Certainly, if this group can stay healthy, I think they can be one of the best rotations in the National League. That being said, if they lose a piece or two, you do wonder where they're going to get those innings from.
One of their late signings was a guy that I think plays a role somewhat in there, if it's as an insurance blanket, if they need an extra starter along the way. But Carlos Villanueva spent the last couple of years with the Cubs. Wherever he's been a very good veteran, very good for the players around him, whether Milwaukee, Toronto, or with the Cubs. I think his value is as a swing guy that he can kind of do whatever you need out of the bullpen. Do you think that's kind of a late move for a guy that could wind up being on the roster all year?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, swing guy is probably the best way to define kind of how he's likely to fit with this team. You know, it's interesting. We talked all winter, and Isle fans in particular talked all winter about how maybe the Cardinals would go out, sign a big-name starting pitcher, kind of fortify the top of that rotation. And all along, general manager John Mozeliak, while, you know, staying in tune with kind of that top market, always said that he looked to be adding depth. And I think this recent signing of Villanueva was for just that. Certainly, he's a guy who can step into the rotation if need be. I think in a perfect world, the Cardinals hope they have other options and don't necessarily need him there. You know, that being said, you look at his numbers and you look at the splits starting and relieving in recent years, he's a very effective arm out of the bullpen. And again, as the Cardinals have some questions with roles being filled in the bullpen, especially depending upon where Carlos Martinez and Marco Gonzalez might be needed. I think Villanueva could definitely fill a need there. You also look at him as a guy who maybe in the middle of the season can make spot starts here and there, especially, with a Cardinals rotation that could have some pitchers not able to hit that 200 innings mark. When you look at Michael Wacha, how many innings could he jump from missing half a year last year? Carlos Martinez, if he pitches for the full season in the rotation, how far can they push him? They could use kind of a 5.5, 6-man type guy, and that could be a Villanueva. So, he comes in as a non-roster guy, certainly not the exciting signing that I think a lot of the Cardinal fans were hoping might be coming, but one that does add to the Cardinals' depth and one that, he can fill a variety of different roles for this team.
Hey, Jen, make no doubt, I love hot stove season, but you touched on one of the phenomenons. If you go back to the general manager's meeting in November, the winter meetings in December, and listen to what John Mozeliak said, you never would have thought the Cardinals were going to go out and sign a high-end guy, trade for a Cole Hamels, but, yet they were kind of on the fringes of all those rumors because we never quite know whether to take a guy at his word or we figure, okay, this is what he said, but what does it really mean? Isn't it kind of nuts that we ask questions, but then we don't really believe they define the answers?
Yeah, there is a lot of posturing at this time of year. And, I think one of the reasons we really started to hear the Cardinals swirling in a lot of these rumors is just because how long it was taking for Max Scherzer and James Shields to sign. The Cardinals were going to be opportunistic, and that's a word that we hear Mo use quite often. They checked in on these guys, absolutely. That's doing your due diligence as a general manager to find out, what these players were seeking, what the market could be. And certainly as time passes and perhaps that market begins to dry up, could the Cardinals have jumped in there? Yeah, and I think what made them an interesting kind of study was they have the financial resources to go big. They did, they still do. They're in a very good place when it comes to their payroll. So that wasn't the issue. The issue more was that a long-term commitment worth making? There's certainly an injury risk when you start talking about how long these contracts are for starting pitchers. And then also this idea of the Cardinals not wanting to block some of their young, budding starting pitchers, guys like Carlos Martinez, Marco Gonzalez, and some others coming up through the system. So, the Cardinals, again, they were involved in the discussions to an extent in that they checked in on these guys. I've got no indication that they were, one of the final bidders for any of these big-name starting pitchers. But, as you mentioned, and especially for the Cardinals, having done their big moves in November, I think people here just wanted something to talk about, something to dream about, and this need for an easy sort of thing to cover the last few weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that did happen, signing of John Jay to a 2-year contract, avoided an arbitration hearing and settled his salary through 2016, after which he's eligible for free agency, caused me to take a step back and look at John Jay and see the numbers on the back of his baseball card, .295 career average, .359 on-base percentage at a time when people are looking for on-base guys. Solid defensive outfielder last year. It was 5 defensive runs saved. Yet he always seems kind of like a fringe guy. He always seems like the guy that's going to get replaced, or at least he has over his couple years as a regular. Why don't we take this guy more seriously? Is it because he was a late bloomer and got there in his mid-20s? Or what is it about the perception of John Jay? Obviously, the franchise views him as an important piece, but he always seems like he's replaceable.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think part of that stems from just the way even the Cardinals viewed John coming into last year. You remember coming into last year, they had gone out and acquired Peter Borges, thinking that they might want a change in center field. John's 2013 season wasn't great. You look at the numbers looking back at it now, it certainly wasn't a terrible year, but given where he had been coming from the previous 2 years, it just wasn't necessarily up to par, and defensively it seemed like he had slowed a step. So, coming into last year, this was a guy that the Cardinals, somewhat projected as a fourth outfielder behind Peter Borges. John came into spring, to his credit, never really saw himself as that, very much developed as a leader in this clubhouse, which, again, can't be found on the back of a baseball card, but I think there's a great value to that here, especially with some changing leadership within the Cardinals clubhouse. And what does he do? He goes out and he wins that starting center field job back. And at the end of the year, you look at his numbers, you can make an argument that he was their best consistent offensive performer from season start to season end. And that's just a credit to kind of the attitude that he came in with. But you're right. I mean, you look at his career numbers, very solid on-base guy, very steady defender, not an elite defender, but good enough in center field. And he's been able to fill a lot of different spots in this Cardinals lineup. I mean, he spent an extended time of period hitting leadoff, did well there, has thrived, you know, quite often hitting in that two-hole, and has also found a way to make it work in the bottom third of the order. So, you know, he's a guy who really in this last year has kind of resurrected his career as a Cardinal. I mean, certainly, I think a year ago, I think a lot of us were looking at last year as probably Jay's last year in this organization, just knowing where his salary was headed through the arbitration process. And he changed all that with the year that he had, and he's been rewarded now with a two-year deal that'll keep him with the Cardinals at least till he hits that free agency time.
How much of it do you think is that on the bases he's just not quite what you want? He makes a lot of outs. And, you know, if you look at those numbers and you put him with a guy that could steal 20 bases without getting thrown out that much, to me, teams would be fighting to get him. And it just seems like a part of his game that could be polished a little more, and I know they've worked with him on it, but I just wonder if that's the piece he's missing.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. He is certainly not an area in which he's really taken off. Now, this team as a whole doesn't really steal a lot of bases, and I'm curious to see if that's going to change this year with a Jason Hayward in the lineup, with Colton Wong now being a little more comfortable and in his eyes, hopefully getting on base a little more regularly than he did last year. But, yeah, I mean, John Jay is not a guy who's developed into a base dealer. I don't think the Cardinals need him to be such necessarily. This is a team that isn't blessed with a ton of speed, just trying to be good base runners in terms of smart base running. And I think that's really where we're going to see this team continue to be maybe a little increase as a team as a whole in the stolen base department, but I wouldn't expect a significant one.
Yeah, a good point about the team philosophy. One last point that I'll let you go, or question, Jen, that I'll let you go. The Cardinals are once again going to have their early program for prospects, which they call the STEP program, spring training early program. And I'm just wondering, out of the guys that they've invited there, the younger players they've invited to Jupiter for March 1st, if there's one or two that really stand out and will be fun to watch.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. This is the first year in a while that the Cardinals have not invited their previous year's first-round draft picks to Major League spring training, but instead they're going to be a part of the STEP program. So, you know, in that case, that's Luke Weaver and Jack Flaherty. I think both pitchers that the Cardinals are interested to see in their first full professional seasons. Rob Kaminsky, a first-rounder from the year before, also a guy that's really climbing up the ladder in terms of how he's being perceived in the organization. So, you know, to me, those are three names that I look forward to seeing. This is the STEP program is a great opportunity for these young minor league players that, again, aren't necessarily ready to be a part of Major League spring training, but by coming in early, they do get exposure in front of the Major League coaching staff. They get some extra sessions. They get to sit through a media session with us in which we talk to them about kind of the expectation between media and players that will develop throughout their career. And what it does is it really prepares them for an opportunity to then step in as kind of fill-in guys during the Grapefruit League season, where they do get to play in a Major League spring training game. So great opportunity for them and fun for us, you know, for those of us who get to cover the team and hear about these prospects coming up but don't actually get to watch them all that much. This is a good opportunity for us to get to see them up close. So, the three pitchers that I mentioned are probably the three that I'm most looking forward to watching throw.
Yeah, great also for fans who come down there can just slide over and watch what's going on the minor league fields, minor league mounds as well. Jen, really enjoy talking to you. Look forward to seeing you in Florida. Joined, as always, by Tom Singer, a man smart enough to get a head start on the offseason, chase the sun. How you doing, Tom?
Doing great, Phil. Thank you. Yeah, it's been kind of nice in Scottsdale. I'm sure it'll be as equally warm in Bradenton soon.
Oh, absolutely. Plus, there you'll have beautiful McKechnie Field, that fine Pirate City complex. You'll be the king of Central Florida, I think, Tom.
Yeah, right. I'm looking forward to that, yes.
All right. Our colleague Anthony Kastorman ranks the top 10 bullpens in the major leagues in a piece he did
for the Sports on Earth site, and he has your Pittsburgh Pirates as the fifth best bullpen in the major leagues. Do you see it as a huge strength of that team? I mean, he points out the ERAs last year for Melanson, Watson, and Hughes. I always looked at it as a really strong bullpen, but some of the personnel's changed over the last couple of years, but they have really kept it going.
Well, yes, it has. Those three guys that you mentioned obviously are at the front of the bullpen, or the back end, as it were. But that actually leaves out a couple of really interesting additions. Antonio Bastardo, the left-hander that acquired from the Phillies, will play a major role. And once again, we're talking about John Holtzgren, the phenom who came up last September and really raised everybody's appetite for what else he could bring, with his 97-mile-an-hour cutter. So, of course, Tony Watson, who was the All-Star last year, first left-handed reliever ever from the Pirates to make the All-Star team. So there's a pretty good six guys right there.
And another thing I want to ask you about on the roster, certainly with Josh Harrison moving all over the field last year before settling in at third base for this year, they seem to really have, between Clint Hurdle and Neil Huntington, a real appreciation for versatile players. And looking at the roster, they had Sean Rodriguez, but in a late move added Steve Lombardozzi. Can they have just a bench full of utility-type guys? Is that kind of the direction they're heading?
Well, absolutely. And there's also Justin Sellers, Pedro Florimon, who I believe was the Kansas City Royals' regular shortstop a couple years ago. So they're really loaded up on guys who can move all over the field. The idea being it gives Hurdle a lot of flexibility in managing late-game situations. Whichever one of those guys or two winds up as being the reserve guy can play all over infield and the outfield. And I think it's a little bit of the San Francisco Giants dynamic, where the lineup isn't so much set, but you can move people around and maximize your whole roster. Somebody like Ben Zobrist a couple years ago, Tony De La Rosa, these guys became really valuable pieces because of their versatility. And I think the Pirates are basically exhibiting an extension of that whole game plan of not being locked into your starting nine.
Another one of those versatile guys, it would seem, has been a shortstop, but Jung Ho Kang, the Korean. You said when last week's podcast, you said you expected him to get a really good look at the start of camp to try to be the shortstop. Is that still kind of the thinking going in? Neil Huntington, I heard on the MLB Network, saying they were going to look at him some at third, some at second as well. Just kind of an open mind with where he fits best.
Well, they do want to move him around, see where else he could play. But the thought going in definitely is to see whether he can handle shortstop at the major league level. That's job number one, without question. And I think, obviously, you've got Jordy Mercer. But if Kang, who has a pretty respectable long-term contract, can handle the position, you would be looking at a situation where the Pirates could perhaps make some moves to strengthen, other parts of the ball club. I'm not saying Mercer is on the block, but obviously the idea with Kang, if he can prove to be a viable major league shortstop, it does give them the option of moving some other people to bolster other parts of the club. But the thought going in definitely is to see whether he can be a shortstop, and then they'll kind of look at other alternatives.
Yeah, if Kane could play shortstop and his power translates to 25 plus homers in the big league, man, I'm not sure there would be a bigger addition around baseball than that. You talk about Matt Kemp with the Padres. I don't know, a power hitting shortstop, that will what a huge asset that would be.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, that's one of the most fascinating aspects of spring training is to see what they do have in Kang, first position player from the Korean baseball organization to sign a major league contract. So it's a big unknown. And there aren't many grand experiments left in Major League Baseball, so to speak, but this is definitely one of them. If it's the real deal, like you said, anybody, a middle infielder who can team with Neil Walker, and on both sides of the keystone, you got guys who have 20 home run bats. I mean, that's a huge, that'd be a huge addition.
Hey, looking at the list of non-roster invites is Jose Tabata. you know, a guy that had an opportunity, didn't take advantage of it, and wound up being outrighted because nobody would take his contract off waivers. Is that going to be an awkward situation, or how do you think Tabata will interact with all these guys that basically took his job?
Well, it is a bit awkward. Actually, he was outrighted twice, the middle of the season and after the season. Jose basically accepted the assignment because still has a long-term contract that he wanted to protect, which kind of says a lot about maybe the lack of competitiveness that has soured the Pirates on him. Basically they're stuck with him at the moment, and given the fact that Corey Hart is another option, a free agent they've signed as an alternative in right field with Gregory Polanco, Jose Tabata doesn't really have a place on this team. His performance last year on the field wasn't really bad at all when he was with the Pirates. He hit about 280, but there's a lot of things below the surface that, Clint Hurdle just is not, enamored with, Jose's attitude or approach, or he's been a little bit injury prone. Maybe that has something to do with his preparation. We don't know the full story, but I mean, he's definitely, he's not only in the doghouse, he's out in whatever's deeper than a doghouse, that's where Jose is.
Yeah. Hey, one last thing, Tom. You mentioned the incredibly positive, very, very wise Clint Hurdle. Been a tough offseason for him physically with surgery on both of his hips. How's he going to be physically for spring training? Will he be able to bounce around the field like you usually see him?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's in a lot better condition than obviously he was at any point last season when, those hip conditions had him limping terribly. He got both of his operations with the idea of being back at full speed for spring training. He got the second one on January 7th. Which is like 8 weeks before spring training really gets going. He's doing a lot of rehab. He's already exercising. He's not going to be jogging, with the pitchers, but he'll definitely be moving around a lot and a lot better than last year. There's no physical concerns with Clint at all.
Well, for myself and other national guys, you'll be seeing a lot of us because we sure do enjoy our time spent talking to Clint. One of the guilty pleasures of your job, I know, that relationship and that time with the manager.
Well, yeah, he's really unique. He's kind of very guarded with his time. He likes to, control the access to him. It's a little bit of disappointment because spring training, you get a lot of quality time with the guys you cover. Clint, it kind of... a private person, as far as that's concerned, you don't get to know him as intimately as maybe some other managers in spring training. But the time you do spend with him is extremely informative and really entertaining. And he's a terrific guy to cover. Good manager, better person.
Yeah, absolutely. Tom, we appreciate it. As always, joined by Adam McCalvey and talking about a Brew Crew team that... as much as any team in baseball, just got a bad news heading to spring training with an untimely injury to a key player, Jonathan LaCroix. Adam, his hamstring, they say 4 to 6 weeks. What's your take on him for opening day? Or do they have to be ready to not have him in April?
You know, I think they're prepared if they don't have him. It would be Martin Maldonado, who, as backup catchers go, is pretty darn good, a superior defensive player, one of the best arms of any catcher in baseball. And they're perfectly comfortable with him handling the staff for a period of time whenever Jonathan Lucroy is out. But that said, you know, everybody's feeling yesterday when this news came was that this is not going to impact his availability for opening day. Even on the, you know, they're saying 4 to 6 weeks, even if you give him the full 6 weeks, that still gives him more than a week before opening day. Jonathan Lucroy also pointed out that this is an issue he played with last season, and really it never came up. I don't remember reporting it. If I did, I just don't remember it. I don't remember it costing him any games. So that is also sort of good news for the Brewers in that he's had some experience in dealing with this. You obviously don't want to go into a season with one of your key players, one of your best hitters, one of the best offensive catchers in baseball, hobbled. So that's why they did an injection this week. They'll rest him a little bit. They'll take it real easy with running in spring training and try to get him back to 100% going into the season. Right now, Jonathan Lucroy's line that would stood out to me the most when I talked to him was, no need to panic. Now, a month from now, if this is still something we're talking about, that changes a little bit.
Hey, could, you know, I know there were plans in spring training to work him some at first base, and you know, try to find ways to get his keep his bat in the lineup on the days he doesn't catch. Is it possible that this could limit to some degree how much he catches in the season, given the strain that catchers take, and that he, you know, if he's not able to bounce back to be 100%. Might they give Maldonado a little bit more time and you know, use Jonathan as a DH if they're playing an American League team or in first base a little bit more than was in the plan?
Potentially, yeah, that would be an option. He started 16 games at first base last year, mostly when the Brewers wanted to give him a break from the grind of catching but not lose his bat. This year, the idea is a little more than that. They signed Adam Lind to play first base, a guy who will give him some pop from the left side, which they wanted and needed. But he struggles against left-handed pitching, so the idea is to play Lucroy on a lot more of those days when the Brewers face, say, John Lester in Chicago. You know, that would give him, though, we're still talking 30 games. We're not talking about a huge number of games. So that, you know, the impact of losing this time in spring training is somewhat mitigated by the fact he's done it before and that we're not talking about him playing 80 games at that position. So I think first base is an option. You know, it's similar to what the Giants are going through with Buster Posey. This is a valuable guy. You want him in the lineup every day if possible. And you have to find a way to, you know, get the most out of him. And for some teams and some players, that means playing him at a different position occasionally. Definitely an option, Phil, as the Brewers move forward.
Yeah, and I'm thinking that even if he is able to get back and be on the opening day roster, there will be a lot of time in the Cactus League opened up for the other catchers, and potentially with an unexpected spot on the opening day roster, potentially a job to win there. Who are some of the guys that you'll be seeing a lot of this spring in Maryville behind the plate?
Well, we were, you know, Maldonado for sure. He's a known entity to the Brewers. The other guy they picked off from waivers from the Mets early in the offseason. We were debating yesterday with Gordash how to pronounce his name, so my apologies if I botch it. I haven't met him yet, but Centeno or Centeno, a guy with some extensive AAA experience. Again, they like what he does behind the plate more than what he does at the plate, so he would be a defense-first guy. And then they have a catcher in their system who's been there for a while, Adam Wiesenberger, who's another quality. You could play defense in the major leagues tomorrow. So they have a little bit of depth in that area. They don't have, though, the all-around player that Lucroy is. And remember, Jonathan Lucroy has emerged as one of the best pitch framers in baseball, and there's a great value to that as well. But you know, I'm just going to say this again. With Martin Maldonado, we're talking about a premier defensive player. The pitchers love throwing to him. and they would not lose anything on defense or in terms of game calling were he to be their number one guy.
Those pitch framing stats, you know, it seems to me like they reward the catchers that get in the deepest crouches. And, you know, that's certainly Jonathan LaCroix, you know, always has that crouch. It'll be interesting to see if his legs aren't 100% this year, if those pitch framing numbers are still quite the same. Certainly the pitchers are hoping they will be.
What he talks about, Phil, is letting the umpire see the ball. That to him is the key to that statistic. You know, so to him, what I hear him talk about a lot are the hands. And it's just giving the umpire a good look at the baseball. So, you know, he's like I said, he's developed into one of the best in the game at it. And, you know, you credit him because coming up, he was more of an offensive guy. At least those are the reports I remember standing out to me as he was coming through the minor leagues. But he's turned himself into a quality defensive player as well. You're talking about low crouch. You're going to like Martin Maldonado then if you get to see him this year, because his idol growing up in Puerto Rico is Benito Santiago. And, you know, he'll do kind of the splits like Benny used to do, and that's kind of fun. You don't see that very much anymore in the game.
There was a signing this week that really didn't impact the Brewers because they had moved on long ago, but Ricky Weeks with a deal with the Mariners. How different is it going to be to go to spring training and not have Ricky Weeks in the clubhouse? I mean, to me, he's practically Gorman Thomas in how long he's been with the Brew Crew.
Yeah, he was there a long time, Phil, and he is a fascinating guy to debate because I think if you stop 10 people on the street here in Milwaukee and ask them their opinion of Ricky Weeks, you get mostly unfavorable, which is tough sometimes for those of us who know the guy because there's never been a prouder player. There's never been a player who worked harder and said less than Ricky Weeks. He did not emerge as this superstar-type player that he was destined supposedly to be when the Brewers took him number two overall. You know, he was supposed to be a special franchise-type player. Injuries kept him from being that, and some stubbornness, frankly, kept him from being that. There were plenty of hitting coaches over the years that told him, you're going to have to make some changes to the way what you do with your hands, that Gary Sheffield style of waggle. Ricky Weeks was never willing to do that. He was not willing last year to try a different position when it would have meant more playing time. But he was a valuable member of a platoon last season for the Brewers. And he did have some success off the bench. He was still a good work-the-count type guy, even in those cold at-bats in the seventh inning. And I think that's going to be valuable if he embraces that role with Seattle, and he embraces perhaps playing somewhere beside second base, which he was unwilling to do in Milwaukee. It wouldn't surprise me to see him have some success there. And listen, at $2 million, that's the report. I mean, that's nothing in today's game. That's a free player. So this is low risk for a guy, Jack Sorensic, who knows well Ricky Weeks' makeup.
I think when he shows up and sees Robinson Cano there, he's probably going to get real flexible in his willingness to move.
I think that would probably behoove him, you know. And then if you have an injury, you've got a guy who can play a little bit. And look, people have said he's not going to hit any homers in Seattle, but to me, Ricky Weeks, his strength is on base. He was a very odd leadoff hitter, but he did it well for Milwaukee because he was a guy who would always work the count and he would find his way on base. So there's some value in that, and I think he still has some games down.
I'd be remiss to ask, spring training fast approaching, but Francisco Rodriguez, K-Rod, still unsigned. The Brewers continuing to monitor that situation. Is there any chance he could wind up back where he started when this spring training begins?
The short answer, Phil, is yes, because it's happened before. Remember, one year he signed back with the Brewers in April and went to the minor leagues and didn't come back to the big leagues until May. So it's always possible. There is a familiarity there and a comfort level there. Couple of things. Ken Rosenthal reported this week, and I've heard the same thing, that he may be going for multi-years. I don't blame him after establishing himself as a closer last season in Milwaukee and the all-star season he had for him and Scott Boras trying to go for 2 years. That might be problematic for the Brewers. Also, did pick up Chris Perez on a minor league deal. Yes, he is a bounce-back candidate. But if he looks great in spring training, that might, you know, further convince the Brewers that they like what they've got. The other thing was in more recent news, Doug Melvin is in Phoenix this week. He saw Jim Henderson and Tyler Thornburg throw bullpens and reported back some surprise at how advanced they are and how good they look. Those are two wild cards for the Brewers and not names that are known around the country necessarily. But remember, Jim Henderson was supposed to be their closer last year before some shoulder troubles forced the Brewers to go to K-Rod. And Tyler Thornburg just a couple of years ago was the number one Brewers prospect, and he was absolutely lights out in April in relief before his elbow started giving him trouble. So those are two guys with the potential to be really good late-inning relievers for this Milwaukee team, and I think they're keeping a close eye on that. So a lot of factors still in the air, including the fact that the Papelbon trade talks might be dormant right now, might be quiet. But, yeah, you know, as Doug Melvin told us, it takes one phone call, and all the groundwork that you laid on that is back to the forefront, and you can quickly make a deal. So that's not something to completely rule out either, especially if Philadelphia gets to a point where they decide they just have to move this guy and they're willing to take a lighter offer for in return for him. So lots of balls in the air there for that Brewers bullpen. It's possible to me that they stick with what they've got. I do think they'd like to add somewhere, and I would say Papelbon and K-Rod remain the leading contenders, even though there are challenges with both.
Yeah, a healthy and effective Thornburg would be huge. I mean, he and Will Smith out of the bullpen, to me, were a big part of their fast start last year. And, you know, once they were down to Will Smith as a setup guy and didn't have the combination, they were kind of a different look. So if they could get him back, you could certainly understand them passing on the bigger ticket options. Adam, thank you very much. As always, joined by Mark Sheldon, excellent Cincinnati beat writer. How you doing, Mark? Getting ready to get to Arizona?
Yeah, as we're talking right now, we got a pretty thick snow coming into Cincinnati. I don't think it's going to stick too much, but I'm hoping it's the last snow I see for the rest of the year because I'll be in Arizona next week.
Well, and I am hoping you don't have any of that snow on April 6th when the Reds have their opening day. This is going to be the 25th anniversary of that unbelievable 1990 World Series when they jumped up and knocked around the Oakland A's. And I see they're going to have the Nasty Boys lead the opening day parade. Before we get to that, just how cool is that event? I mean, given the Reds' history with always having, you know, having the traditional opener, it seems like opening day of Cincinnati is a little different than everywhere else.
Yes, it really is treated like a local holiday. A lot of kids are unofficially excused from school, so to speak, and obviously a lot of people take some time off of work, and they have a huge parade. I don't think any other team in the league does this. It's been a venerable tradition. It's one of the reasons that baseball is so big here. They're able to do it every year around the same time because the Reds always have the honor of opening at home, being the oldest team in professional baseball. That's something they've been able to do most of the time throughout their history. So the parade's kind of the kickoff, and then the game's, a little later in the day. So it's a big deal. It's a really big deal around here.
Well, hey, Mark, with this being the 25th anniversary of the Nasty Boys team and a lot of promotions and activities planned around that team, do you think there's any chance that we could get a Lou Piniella, Rob Dibble, WWE wrestling event at some point?
You know, Phil, I have a feeling they probably made up by then. But, it's been a long time. It's been 25 years. It's hard to believe. I was a freshman at the University of Cincinnati that year, and I actually attended Game 2 of the World Series at Riverfront Stadium. It was a great season, and with Eric Davis and Barry Larkin being kind of big superstars of the team, but the Nasty Boys were kind of the heart and soul that – documentary on MLB Network a couple of weeks ago really brought that home, is that these guys kind of were the character of the team. They were the guys that brought the intensity, and they're a huge reason why the Reds were able to lock down games after the sixth inning.
Hey, if I was a scout, this guy, I think, especially nationally, has kind of been, history's kind of washed over him a little bit, Eric Davis. Great player, If I was a scout, he would be everything I would look for in an outfielder. To me, he's like the classic speed power guy. Is he just not textbook?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. He had it all, especially in the late 80s when he was coming on. He could hit for power. He could run fast. He could do it all. And really, I talked to him recently for a story that's going to be going up soon. Is in that 1990 World Series in Game 4, he made a diving attempt on a Willie McGee kind of tailing line drive and lacerated his kidney. And he thinks it took him about 3 years to really fully recover from that. And you can see his numbers after 1990 kind of start declining, and he never felt the same. And, of course, he had some other injuries and some big back problems, and, of course, he had cancer. And I think really the latter half of his career, he wasn't able to show the kind of numbers he had in the first portion of his career. And you kind of wonder what might have been. He was already a great player with the Reds, but you wonder if maybe, you could start talking about Cooperstown, over 17 years if he was able to have some more healthy seasons.
Yeah, I mean, as great a player as Barry Larkin is, if I had a choice, it would be a tough one at their prime between those guys. Moving back to the year 2015, Mark, I see you recently had the privilege to listen to Sharon Robinson speak in an event at the Urban Youth Academy in Cincinnati. And not just that event, but the Youth Academy itself in Cincinnati. What do you see the significance of that and as part of Major League Baseball's effort to get more guys playing baseball and make baseball more accessible to really good athletes?
Yeah, it's an impressive place. The facility itself is every bit Major League quality. I mean, these are kids that are ages about 9 to 18 that are getting to play baseball, but they're getting a top-notch facility. And I've been out there a couple times now, and one of the things that's great about it is it is getting kids that may not otherwise have foregone and given up on baseball and having them brought back. They're really working, especially on the teenagers, to get them to stay in baseball. And there's one coach out there, an ex-minor leaguer with the Reds named Cameron Satterwhite, who is considered kind of a Pied Piper of sorts of drawing boys that were maybe on the verge of quitting and getting to stay. They have a very extensive weightlifting program, which the boys seem to like, and they're also learning, baseball skills. And a lot of coaches from, University of Cincinnati and Xavier University come over and help out. And every now and again, some ex-Reds and current Reds participate in some of the clinics. So it's been a nice thing. And then Sharon Robinson was there to encourage young kids in grades 4 through 9 to write essays for the Breaking Barriers essay contest. And that can result in a trip to the All-Star game or a laptop computer. It's kind of a way of just showing how to express themselves and to show character and get around adversity. And as you know, Maggie Zanies was one of the winners of that contest in 2011, and she's obviously gone on to a pretty good special thing.
Absolutely. Looking ahead to spring training, one guy I'm really looking forward to seeing, I hope I'm able to catch him in a game, is Raisel Iglesias, Cuban signing of the Reds, and to me an asset. He's kind of gone a little bit under the radar. I was thinking more likely to be a bullpen guy than a starter, but it sounds like he's going to get a real chance to win a spot at the bottom of that rotation, or at least has a chance this spring to break out. Tell me a little bit about him. What's his package of tools?
Well, he's easily the most intriguing player I'm looking forward to seeing this spring. Like you said, he kind of flew under the radar, and a lot of teams had projected him as a bullpen guy, but the Reds really were adamant that they thought he could start, and if it didn't work out, then they could put him in the bullpen. And he didn't get to pitch much last year because of his defection. He was in Haiti, and he had to wait for a visa to get to the United States upon signing. But he got to the Arizona Fall League and threw 7 games, 7 innings, all scoreless, allowed 1 hit, struck out 7. And the Reds came away pretty impressed. They feel like he's got three or four good pitches. He's got low to mid-90s fastball that they really like. He can move it around a lot, and they just like what they have with him. So they feel like you know, maybe in a perfect world, he'd get a little bit more experience in the minor leagues just to get comfortable pitching here. But if he comes out and blows their doors off and makes it really hard, he could push his way onto the roster, either as a rotation guy or a bullpen guy.
Well, maybe the opposite experience from Aroldis Chapman when he got there with all the huge expectations. And, you know, in a lot of ways, he was alone as a Cuban. How much of a help would you anticipate it would be for Iglesias that he'll have Aroldis Chapman around to kind of show him the ropes?
I think that can only help. And, of course, catcher Brian Pena, who is also Cuban, will be there. And you know, Pena is just a gregarious kind of fellow. And I know he's already been in contact with Iglesias. He's been catching some of his bullpens in Miami. So I would imagine that between the three of them, there'll be a nice little relationship there. And there's obviously other Latin players to see, not just Cubans, that will make him feel comfortable. And it'll be, you know, interesting to see. I got to meet him when he signed last summer, and he seems like a pretty nice guy. And I'm looking forward to seeing him pitch. I haven't seen him pitch yet. I'm pretty excited about it.
Yeah, I'll be right there with you, whether it's a backfield or in a big game this spring. Wanted to watch him. So, Mark, I do appreciate it. Safe travels down to Arizona. As always, joined by the very wise Terry Muscat. Getting an early start on spring training, headed to Arizona, proof that the early bird gets the worm, but not as much as John Lester, another early to Arizona person. And what a little time John Lester's had out there in Arizona, Jerry.
I actually haven't seen him, but I've heard about him, and apparently he scored a hole-in-one yesterday.
Yeah,
that's pretty impressive. You know, was playing golf with Eric Hinsky and Travis Wood and Evan Longoria, and he shot a hole in one on the seventh hole of the Estancia. So that's for your first round. If you're going to play your first round of golf, that's what you want is a hole in one to get you started.
And this is a guy who's always had his spring training in Florida, so. Welcome to the Cactus League, big fella.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I would think that would make him pretty happy. So, yeah. And it's a tough hole. It's not exactly it wasn't exactly an easy hole either. But unfortunately, what you don't want to do, he posted a photo of the ball and his scorecard. What you don't want to do is look at his other scores because they're not quite as impressive as the one. But let's just keep in mind that it was the first round, and we'll go from there. An ace for an ace.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's smart of him, though, to get a running start, get out to Arizona early, and you know, be able to work out with some of Starlin Castro, I know, has been there, and just kind of to get his get grounded for his first spring outside of Fort Myers, don't you think?
Yeah, I think it's probably the best thing for him is to kind of get to know everybody out here. He and Jason Hamill's also a big golfer, so I'm sure the two of them will somehow find their way onto a golf course at some point in the desert. It's just kind of getting acclimated, getting comfortable in your surroundings, getting, you know, a feel for where everything is. I mean, it's a whole new. Yes, he was traded in the middle of last season, but this is starting from, you know, day one, and he's talked before about how spring is really important. It's a good time to kind of mesh with your teammates, get to know everybody, get to know who you can count on. It's just a really critical time. So he's kudos to him for coming down here so early.
Another part, a different part of that Cubs pitching staff, the bullpen, our colleague Anthony Castrovitz ranks the top 10 bullpens in a piece that's actually on the Sports on Earth site. And the Cub bullpen came in at number 7. I've also seen pieces elsewhere just talking about the power right-handers at the end in Rondon, Ramirez, and Strope, comparisons to how that could be kind of the starter kit to a bullpen like the Royals had last year. How big of a strength do you think that's going to be? And what a change from those early Theo Epstein years when they just kept running guys through the bullpen.
Yeah, I think the bullpen is kind of a not talked about but much improved area on the team, and it's mainly because of the growing pains they've had to go through for the last couple of years. You know, Justin Grimm, Neil Ramirez are so much better because of, you know, what they've learned over the, you know, in the last couple of years. Same with Rondon. Now, whether or not, I guess Madden, from what I could gather from Madden at the Cubs convention, he might not stick with one closer, so I'm not sure if Rondon is the main guy or if he'll slip Jason Mott in there a couple times. You know, Mott will be a real key piece down there because he's got the experience and he can sort of keep an eye on the kids and make sure they're all going in the right direction. Mott is also early arrival here in Arizona, which is nice to see, you know, for the same reasons as Lester, you know, trying to get settled, get used to a new environment. But the one thing they need to kind of figure out is if they, you know, who's going to be the main lefty down there. I'm not quite sure that's set. It'll just, you know, the kid that they picked up, they claimed from the Red Sox, Dennis Britton,
yep.
That'll be an interesting guy to watch. So he could be that guy.
Yeah, I like Drake Britton.
Drake Britton, I'm sorry.
A little bit when
Dennis Britton
Boston
is somebody else.
A young guy, the Red Sox just has so many pitching prospects that they kind of crowded him off the roster and claimed on waivers. Another guy claimed on waivers earlier this year, the Ortiz from Texas. He's another guy that has experience and could be an interesting guy. What is your expectation for Mott, Kerry? I know he, the last couple of years, that's a guy that nailed down the last out of the World Series while he's with the Cardinals, had Tommy John surgery, came back late last year. Will he be 100% clear, ready to go for the start of camp?
That, from all signs of things, yes. So that's and talking to him in the off season, he feels 100% and is ready to go. I guess his feeling was that the Cardinals were going with a few more kids, younger arms, and a little different direction, and maybe it was time for him to explore his other options, which is why he left. They don't have Carlos Vee in the wave, and they don't have Wesley Wright, and those two guys, you know, fans might look at their numbers and say they weren't that great numbers-wise, but those two guys were real keys in terms of mentoring the younger players, and Mott's going to take over that role as well as being somebody they're going to count on out of the bullpen to get out.
Yeah, there really isn't. I mean, if you were going to quibble, you would maybe look at the lack of experience from that group. Pedro Strope,
right,
becomes one of the more experienced guys there. But one other thing on the bullpen, and this is a guy that you probably haven't had a chance to see yet, and he doesn't seem to have created much buzz, but to me he's a really interesting guy, is Armando Rivero, a Cuban who was one of the non-roster guys, actually signed for $3 million. I mean, it's not like he's a guy that was just out there in the pack. And last year, very quietly in their system, 100 strikeouts in 65 innings, holding opponents to a 189 batting average. I don't know. To me, this is another big arm guy that could be another nice piece. And a thing that good bullpens have is depth. You know, extra guys like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know Jason McLeod, the head of scouting and player development during the Cubs convention, he pointed out Rivero and said, keep an eye on this guy because he's not far from the big leagues because of the power arm. He is older, and it's just a matter of, you know, experience and more time, you know, with their system. But they do like him a lot, and I wouldn't be surprised if we didn't see him in 2015 with the Cubs.
Hey, this is a little off the beaten track, but, you know, the Cubs are a team that can't really sign a Yoan Moncada, the hot Cuban. Everybody calls him a shortstop, but people say he's more likely to be a third baseman or a second baseman, but a 19-year-old Cuban prospect that's going to get a boatload of money. And because the Cubs spent so heavily in the previous signing period, they could only sign him if he waited until July to sign, and it looks like he's close to being cleared and ready to sign. But I read a report the Cubs have a private workout set up with him. Do you think that's totally just due diligence, or is there any way they could find a way to finagle a big international signing?
To me, it's due diligence on their part, but I also, it would just be a matter of whether or not Mankato is willing to wait. They can't offer a bonus any higher than $250,000 until July 2nd. So, you know, I'm not sure. I saw photos of Mankato. He sure looks like he's ready to go, even though he is young, but he sure looked ready. But the Cubs just have to, you know, they're obviously going to keep an eye on him and keep an eye on, and keep their foot in the door, but I'm just not sure that's a match that they could make. It'd really be up to the young man.
Yeah, and what was your take on James Shields? The Cubs, monitored that for a long time and then apparently came in late with an offer that, let's say, the Padres had wound up trading for Cole Hamels instead of signing James Shields. Maybe Shields could have wound up with the Cubs. What was your take on the Cubs in that process?
Well, I think that the Cubs were involved. I just don't think they were involved at Shields, you know, at a four-year deal. If Shields would have considered maybe 3 years, I think they might have been able to work something out. But he obviously wanted longer term. And I'm just amazed that, no, this is the first time a pitcher, a free agent, has signed, over $50 million after February 1st. It's amazing to me that it took this long to get this done. But I think also the Cubs are keeping an eye on the free agent class after next year, after 2015, sorry, get confused. They're keeping an eye on the free agents after 2015, so there might be somebody in that class that they would want, or they could pick up somebody in July in a trade to look forward to 2016. I think 2015 is going to be better for the Cubs, but it's not. They're still developing. And I think fans are going to keep their expectations in check. They're still in the development phase, and it's just a matter of, you know, let's wait another year and let these guys all gel. Let's get Chris Bryant up there and go from there.
Yeah, exactly. And who knows? Maybe I've never really bought into Cubs with Cole Hamels at this point because I don't think they want to part with the minor league inventory they built up.
No.
Maybe if he's still on the market in July and they're actually in the playoff picture, that's a different set of circumstances then. So it's going to be very interesting. And luckily for all of us, we won't have to wait too long until they open the gates to spring training and we get to see these guys on the field and stop just talking about them all the time. Thanks very much for joining us. Thanks for listening. This has been Phil Rogers, MLB.com Extras, National League Central Edition.